You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh boy. Large wedge tornado coming up in 2 hours.
A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
So we can expect at least another 2 to 4 inches overnight. Then that snow's
coming. The National Weather Service in Huntsville has issued a tornado warning for northwestern Minnesota.
14 to 22 inches of snow!
Good Thursday evening. Thank you for joining us here on the Weather Junkies. It's Thursday, July 7th, so we've made it through a third of meteorological summer, and July 4th is now in the past, unfortunately, because I know the saying goes that everything, you know, just goes away so quickly once we get past the 4th. But anyways, I'm Tyler Jankowski, as always, joining the show from Connecticut alongside Dakota Smith in Colorado. Dakota.
Hey, Tyler, and hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight. It's another hot day in Colorado. I believe we reached 90 degrees again. And I have a beautiful weather otherwise, sunny skies, no storms today. Storms will start back up tomorrow. We're actually in a slight risk out here along the Front Range tomorrow, so we could have some severe weather. But can't really complain besides the heat. Tyler, how's the weather in Bristol?
Well, we've had our really first oppressive humidity of the summer. I don't know. For me, it hasn't felt that bad. Maybe it's because I'm not outside that much during the day. But the dew point when I last looked at my weather station was 73. But that's because we had some rain and the temperature hit the dew point. But, you know, we got nearly an inch of rain here with some thunderstorms today. So that was really needed. We're down more than a foot when you look back a year and a half. So a lot of the lawns are brown. And even the local farm stand has delayed its opening because not many things are ready. But I'm hopeful that they don't have the year that they had last year when they had to close on like Labor Day and they didn't have any corn after Labor Day because
Yikes. It
was so dry. And let me tell you, that corn is very good.
Yeah, I bet. So let's get straight into the Twitter section today. We have Brad Gay on. It's a pre-recorded interview, so we'll play that after our Twitter section. But I'll go ahead and start it off here with a tweet that sparked a little bit of a controversy on Twitter. It's from Mark Weinberg. He's a on-air meteorologist, chief meteorologist in Louisville, Kentucky. You can follow him at Mark Weinberg, WX. And his tweet says, "I think a degree in meteorology is the only assurance of what you are dealing with." And this is a string of tweets that he sent out really about how he doesn't think that – I guess he doesn't like that people who don't have degrees are calling themselves meteorologists and forecasting and sharing their forecasts on the internet. And I sent out another tweet and asked, you know, non-degreed people in our community what they thought about this. And it was actually a really nice conversation, and a lot of thoughts are put out there. The thing I took away from it the most, and a lot of people commented about this, is how their degree, not necessarily their degree in their classes, but the extracurriculars were the most important thing for forecasting. And their degree really helped them for data analysis and research purposes, but the forecasting part came outside of class. So Tyler, I'm curious what you think about this.
Well, my initial impression was he's spot on. You know, we have so many fake things out there, and the only real way to know is to see if someone has a meteorology degree. But upon further thought, there are people that I have a lot of respect for that don't have a full-blown meteorology degree but are very good weather communicators. The one person that comes to mind is Jeff Fox. He used to work here in Connecticut. A lot of respect for him. I love the way he presented the weather. And he had a lot of fans here in Connecticut. He didn't have a full meteorology degree. So my thought is, you know, I fully agree with, you know, a lot of the forecasting things and things that you use on a daily basis. You probably didn't get directly from your degree. You learned somewhere along the way, either through extracurricular activities or once you actually started working professionally. But the point that I would agree with Mark on is the foundation is poured with the meteorology degree. So you're less likely to make a stupid remark. You're less likely to do something that makes no sense if you have a meteorology degree, even if you learn some of the more useful things on your own. So I think it is that solid foundation with no cracks that's hard and solid that allows you to branch off and learn new things. But if you don't have that foundation, it's easy for you to stray down in the wrong direction. So I think there's absolutely a point here.
Yeah, so you mentioned Jeff Fox, and I looked him up, and he has a certificate in broadcast meteorology from Mississippi State. So what do you think about that? Does that count as a degree? Or I actually have no idea what their program is.
No.
Like, if you get that certificate.
Well, here's my opinion. A degree is a four-year degree where you do four semesters of calculus. Basically, will the National Weather Service hire you? That is a degree. I'm not talking about something that's fluffy that makes a university money. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. I know there are varying things at Mississippi State. Mississippi State does offer a four-year degree. But, you know, you brought Jeff up again. A lot of respect for him. He is very good at what he does. I have taken advice from him before, and I think he does a great job. But if you're talking about the subject of a degree, my opinion is that it's one that would be recognized by the National Weather Service. Because, you know, when you try to sort through all of this, a lot of times you run into something you don't agree with. But the National Weather Service requirements are pretty stringent. I think I agree with all of them.
You know, another person that you could bring up here is James Spann, because he has the same thing. He has a certificate from Mississippi State, and he is, you know, one of the de facto broadcast meteorologists.
That's a great point. So, I mean, my definition of a degree doesn't change.
Yeah.
It's a whole nother subject area when you bring up who do you respect and who is very good at what they do. That's a totally different subject area. Because obviously we all know about James Spann and the other examples that we brought up. So like I said, I think it's really the foundation, and that it doesn't mean that other people can't figure things out along the way. It just means you're less likely to. And the reason I say that is because we have plenty of examples of people that don't have a clue what they're doing.
Yeah. So I'll end it on this note, unless you have something else to add, but I kind of got from it that people who are really good at forecasting sometimes don't have degrees and can be really good at forecasting just through all of their experience by analyzing models, by analyzing observations, maybe doing a little bit of reading even in various textbooks. And I thought maybe AMS or NWA should step up and give some sort of forecasting seal. They have various seals. AMS has a CCM, which is a consulting meteorologist. And then they have a broadcast meteorologist seal. And then NWA has two as well, I think. And I don't know if it's necessary, but it seems like something that would maybe if they could handle a situation that they're given and forecast really well in like an exam or like a test or something, they could get that kind of approval. I don't know if it's even necessary, if it's worth it, but well, something to think about.
Just quickly here, a lot of the angst is because in this field, a lot of people who are absolutely unqualified and don't have a clue what they're doing are, you know, put into roles that are very high-ranking roles, make a lot of money. I think that's why this is such a hot topic.
Yeah.
But there are absolutely qualified people out there that don't have the four-year degree that people think of that involves the math and the science. And in some ways, that may be a more impressive accomplishment to gain the respect of your entire field, and you don't even have a degree.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, you know, we could probably dedicate an episode to this, so maybe we'll do that in the future. But let's move on here. Our next tweet is from a friend of mine, Dan Lindsay. He's over at a NOAA facility in Fort Collins, and he has a lot of awesome satellite imagery tweets. And this one is of the super typhoon Nepartok, and it's a full day of the eye, and oh my gosh, it is mesmerizing. I know this thing's going to cause a lot of damage, and you know, not it won't be pretty when it comes on shore, but overseas, it's pretty amazing. I have some stats here. Right now, it's a Cat 4, I believe, with sustained winds at 150 miles an hour, wind gusts up to 185 miles per hour. And it looks like it's going to make landfall tonight, probably tomorrow morning, actually, early tomorrow morning, make landfall. So really impressive imagery here.
Yeah, there's nothing that beats those, I guess, in this case, 2.5-minute satellite images. Speaking of satellite, I noticed today in the Northeast that the GOES satellite was updating every 5 to 10 minutes, and that surprised me. I know that they sometimes have scan areas that are much more frequent, but usually those are a little bit harder to access. But this was on the NEGSLAB page where the satellite, I could just tell by looking at it. I was like, oh my gosh, the clouds are moving differently, like more frequently.
Yeah.
So I don't know what changed. I don't know if it was just NEGSLAB or if there was something else that changed.
Interesting. I could ask Dan about that because he always has the GOES loops up and just keep an eye on that. Those 1 minute scans. I cannot wait until those 1 minute scans are an everyday thing.
Yeah.
So let's move on here to our second to last social media thing. This one is from the AMS handle. You can follow them at AMETSOC. And they tweeted, in new bulletin AMS study, model with 30-meter grid resolution simulates a storm and its associated long-lived EF5 tornado. So this is kind of in the research corner here. Some state-of-the-art work from a number of collaborators. Lee Orff looks like he's the lead on it. He's over in the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at Wisconsin-Madison. And they really found a lot of cool and important processes to the formation of tornadoes and how that happens. There's a lot of big words, chunky words, and I won't get into, but you should, if you have the chance, take a minute and read this. It's an awesome read. Even if you read their abstract, you could probably get a sense of what they're doing, but the paper itself is really good. They used a cloud CM1. It's a cloud model, which I've actually done some work in, but what they're doing is, you know, beyond my ability. So really cool read here. Take a read to it if you can.
That is something I want to click on. Just for perspective, you know, the HRRR is basically probably the highest resolution operational model there is, unless I'm wrong. But 3 kilometers would be 3,000 meters, and this is a 30-meter grid, so it's so much higher resolution than even the highest resolution thing we would show in a forecast. So that is definitely something that I'll have to look into.
Yeah, if you go into YouTube and, like, I don't know, search for CM1 tornado video, there's a few awesome videos of you can actually, it's a 3D visualization of the tornado, and I can't imagine how much computing power that takes because it's a lot of data points and a lot of data.
We have one more post tonight. It's not a Twitter post, but it's a Facebook post, so it's on the same line, social media. The Storm Prediction Center Facebook page posted that it's SPC lead forecaster Steve Corfiti's last day at the Storm Prediction Center. He is retiring after 36 years of service at the National Weather Service, and he was the lead forecaster at the SPC for the last 22. The name may sound familiar because you may have heard of the Corfiti vector. You can look up the definition if you haven't heard of it, but he has his place in the field of meteorology, and he's retiring today, so there will be a new director of the Storm Prediction Center.
Have you had the chance to ever meet Steve at all?
No.
Huh. Yeah, I actually don't know much about him, but yeah, sounds like he was a really good forecaster and did a lot.
Big retirement, like a little mini earthquake in the weather community. Mentioned.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into the main topic tonight. And we're joined by Brad Gay. He's a Penn Stater. Like last week, we promise we're not going to have Penn Staters for the next few weeks. not that it's a bad thing, but you know, people want a little mix up.
I've heard the slate of people coming out in the next couple months. I was even impressed.
Yeah, it should be fun. But yeah, let's get to today's main topic here: a recap of Twirl 2016. It was the most recent tornado field research campaign, and Brad Gay gave us he showed a few stories, gave a little recap, and so let's just go on and dig in. And now we're joined by Brad Gay. He's a graduate from Penn State with a bachelor's in meteorology in 2015. He helped start the Penn State Chase team, and most recently he was working on the Twirl field project. And he just got a job at Risk Management Solutions. Brad, thanks for joining us. A lot has been going on in the past month or two in your life. So first of all, congrats on the job, by the way. And congrats on graduating. That's like the 1-2 punch there. Graduate, get the job. How's everything been?
Hey, thanks, Dakota. It's great to be here. Yeah, things are going very well for me at the moment. Really happy to be employed at RMS. Really looking forward to getting started in Hoboken. And of course, just had a great time out on Twirl with the Center for Severe Weather Research. Really nice project. I think we collected a lot of great data and certainly learned a lot.
So before we get into Twirl, I'm curious. Do you have an idea of what you might be doing at RMS to start?
Yeah, so I'm going to be working on the global sales team at RMS. And you might ask, like, what's a meteorologist doing working in sales? So what RMS does is they produce global catastrophe risk models. And what these models do is they predict the risk of various disasters, both natural and man-made, worldwide. And that information has been packaged into a software platform and sold to the insurance industry. And it's used by a large portion of the insurance and reinsurance companies worldwide. Now, the value proposition of hiring a meteorologist into a sales role is I can go to these companies and say, okay, here's our product. I'm a meteorologist. I understand how this works. And here's how this can benefit you as you try to set your premiums.
Okay. And will you be like working it with a lot of code at all, or is that kind of behind the scenes and you're more of pitching and understanding the model?
No, the people making the model are much smarter than me. Those are people with master's degrees and PhDs. I'll be more on the client facing side. So working directly with their clients.
Okay. Gotcha. So good luck with all that. Looking forward to hearing what you do there in the future. I wanted to get into Twirl and chasing because this episode's all about Twirl, kind of like a recap of Twirl, essentially. I know there were two cars in Twirl, so you kind of might just have the one main side of it. I guess why did you decide to go on the trip, and how did you get into that position to be in part of the field mission?
So I was referred to Twirl by Dr. Paul Markowski at Penn State. His colleagues with the two lead investigators on Twirl, Dr. Josh Berman and Dr. Karen Gasiba, they were looking for assistants, recent graduates or students who would be able to come out for this project and basically provide support and provide some extra manpower as they complete this mission. So Dr. Markowski knew that I graduated and that I had a little bit of time to me, and ended up working out pretty well.
Yeah, that's awesome. So how long were you out there again?
So the project started the end of April. We started training, and then it wrapped up about June 20th or so.
Yeah. And how many, what's the ballpark of how many storms or how many tornadoes you ended up chasing during the entire trip?
So I believe it was 8 tornadic supercells. Mm-hmm. Now, each of those, some of those produced several tornadoes, some of them only produced one or two. So I don't actually have a number on how many tornadoes we saw. I guess it's kind of a gray area when you see, say, a storm produces a tornado, it lifts briefly, then the same circulation puts down another. Or in the case of Dodge City, where we had as many as 2 to 3 tornadoes going on at once. So it's hard to provide an exact number, but I'd say that 8 tornadic supercells is the number, and that was over 17,000 miles over the course of that 7-week project.
That's a lot of miles. So you brought up Dodge City. Tell me about how awesome that was, because I've seen your pictures, I've seen other people's pictures, and it's just amazing. And did you get any data from that day? And if what kind of data did you get from that?
Yeah, the Dodge City day was something that was incredible to witness in person. I don't think I'll ever see anything like that again. Just the way that storm developed. I believe, got some fairly good data. I think the Dow was close enough to get some pretty good scans. There's actually one scan where the Dow had gotten stuck in a ditch, which wasn't awesome, but they ended up in the middle of the two tornadoes. So there's one scan where you can see two couplets on either side of the Dow, and the Dow is sitting in the middle of the two tornadoes. Other than that, one of the other goals of the project was to be able to drop these instrument packages, as we call them, pods, into the tornado, and those measure temperature, wind speed, humidity, pressure, things like that. And the goal is to get those in the path of the tornado and have it get hit. I believe we got one of them hit by one of the tornadoes in Dodge City. I don't think it was a direct hit by, say, when the tornado was, I believe it was an EF3, but a weaker hit. But it's still going to be good data for us to have.
Yeah, that's incredible. You had a picture of, there were 3 funnels at one point. Was that the picture?
Yeah, there were 3 funnels at one point. I didn't manage to get a picture of that. I was sitting in the back of the car, so it was kind of hard to get that shot. But I did get one picture of 2 at once, and that was definitely impressive.
Yeah, that's amazing. So for those of you that don't know, I actually had to look it up. TWRL stands for Tornadic Winds, Institu and Radar Observations at Low Levels. And you guys were kind of like a 2-fold data collection. You had the Dow with the radar, and then you had pods that you were deploying to get, you know, tornadic data. So did any of your pods actually end up being intercepted by a tornado?
Yeah, we had a couple of pods that that got hit by the tornado. I think the Dodge City day we had one, and then on the Wynnewood Sulphur, Oklahoma tornado day back on May 9th with that EF4, we had a pod get into the maybe outer edges of the core flow, which I think that was exciting. I mean, it's very difficult to get these pods directly in the path of the tornado. And there's been very, very limited success by pretty much everyone who's tried to do it since we started chasing tornadoes. So I think that was exciting. And then also to have that radar data directly overlaid with the pod and Mesonet data is excellent, to be able to look at what the radar was reading and then compare that to actual ground truth. I think that's going to be the best data.
Yeah, that's awesome. And tell me about the Sulphur tornado day, because I think you told me a story and I was just like, oh my gosh, when I guess you were like really close to it and there were winds and debris, and like, tell me about that kind of experience.
Yeah, so the Sulphur tornado day, that was my first major tornado that I had ever seen. And I was driving one of the Mesonet vehicles. The Mesonets are like a Dodge Ram pickup truck with a mast mounted on it that has an anemometer and other instruments. And then we carry the pods in the bed in the back. So on the Sulphur Wynnewood day, we were watching this tornado develop. And it really intensified pretty quickly. Before we knew it, we had a half mile wide or so wedge type tornado on the ground. And we were trying to get ahead of it. It ended up getting ahead of us. So the thing that I remember most vividly is the tornado was moving to the east, and we found a road also going to the east that was maybe a half mile north of the tornado. So we were coming down this road trying to get ahead of it, race ahead of it, and then get in front, drop the pod, and get out. So we got about a half mile behind the tornado, and then it kind of started wobbling to the north. So we were thinking, okay, maybe it's time to back off a little bit as we're watching these power lines getting ripped down and trees. And then at one point I looked up and there was a house going by almost above us rather than in front of us.
That's incredible. So it was,
it's definitely humbling to see that in person. It gives you a new perspective on tornadoes.
Yeah. Would you say that was your most intense moment of the trip for you?
Yeah, I'd say it was, because I was still pretty new to the whole chasing thing, especially being at close range like that.
Mm-hmm.
So especially being in control of the vehicle at that point, I'd say that was the most intense moment of the trip for me and maybe of my life.
Yeah. Wow. You were telling me how you did a lot of, you had to core punch, you know, frequently to get to a certain part of the storm. What was that like? I think you were telling me that you're kind of desensitized to that since you did it so many times and everything always was okay. And I'm scared of that stuff. So, I guess tell me about how that kind of process of nail punch, core punching and what you know now about it.
Yeah, so chasing on my own and with Penn State, I was always scared to core punch because, you know, you get all the hail and it's hard to see and you can't really tell where the tornado was. The only reason I felt comfortable with it with Twirl was because we had the full resources of CSWR and the DAOs, being able to tell us exactly where the tornado was at all times.
Gotcha.
Which way it was moving, if anything unusual was happening. And then going through the core, of course, we don't have to really worry too much about the vehicle being damaged. I mean, obviously we don't want to lose a windshield, but we can proceed with caution, drive at a slower speed, watch how big the hail gets. If it gets too big, then maybe we turn back. But we didn't really, I mean, a couple of vehicles, they didn't necessarily like have a windshield cave in, but they replaced. Mm-hmm. But I found that core punching was not as bad as I'd expected once finally got into it.
So you mentioned you, that's awesome, by the way, because that, you know, a lot of times you need to do it when you're chasing and you don't want to. So you talked about how you had the full resources of CWR, and I'm curious, what's the decision making process like? I guess we can start at like the night before or the morning of. Where do you guys start to choose a chase location?
So ideally, we're looking at chase locations a few days in advance. Just kind of have that in the back of our minds, where we want to end up in the next few days. Of course, there's pretty good information on where tornadoes are likely to develop a few days in advance, both from our own forecasting and from the Storm Prediction Center. So we kind of get an idea of where we need to target, and then say we finish chasing one night, and we know where we need to be the next day. We'll try to make at least a couple hours of headway towards that area. We'll stay in a hotel. We try to be in not too late just so that everyone can get some good rest, because it is pretty exhausting and draining being out there chasing. But by the next morning, we'll wake up, reevaluate, look at the overnight model runs, and then figure out where we need to target for that day. And then that's when the driving begins. And the driving may not stop until 10 o'clock that night, because we'll say drive to initial target destination that may be 5 hours away, sit in a parking lot for an hour, grab a bite to eat, then realize, okay, we need to be another 2 hours north. And then by then the chasing has started and it's really go, go, go. I mean, there's not many breaks in there. Some days, I mean, other days we have a pretty good idea where we need to be and we're right there in the morning, so we can just kind of wait it out.
Yeah.
And wait until the storms come to us. But there's a lot of days when we're just moving and moving and moving and doing, say, close to 500-700 miles in a day.
Yeah, damn. So what about during the chase, like picking cells to go after? Do you have someone who makes that call, or is it like kind of like a group decision? How's that go?
It's a fairly democratic process. The end decision does come down to Josh and Karen as the PIs on the project. But they'll go over the radio and they'll ask, okay, does anyone have any opinions on which storm we should target? Or how do you think this looks? Or what have the models been saying? And then people will chime in over the radio and say, okay, I like this cell because it looks like it's developing pretty nicely and it's in a nice environment. But then someone else might pick a different cell. So that debate is pretty much ongoing all day over the radio. People are talking about where they want to target and which storm is looking the best. And then eventually we will choose one and then go right into chase mode.
And so what's the setup for like internet and radar? Are you using radar scope or are you using the Doppler and wheel? And does everyone have like a laptop that they can be on during the chase?
So Dow 7, which is where Josh Gorman and Karen Kasiba sit, they have the internet connection. So they're able to have someone sitting on the PC and getting all of that information. They have a pretty good antenna. So when we're in areas without regular cell service, they're usually able to get at least something.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the rest of the vehicles, it's pretty much up to people on their cell phones looking at radar scope. And then we have a PC with navigation software, and that's how we can also view our Mesonet data in real time. But for the most part, we're using radar scope just to get a good broad picture of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Then once we're on a specific storm, then we can get the live real-time information from the Dows, which is very helpful when we have people who are maybe in a little bit dangerous situations to be able to get that live information about where the tornado or possible tornado is.
Gotcha. And so the data you guys collected, that's currently being, I'm assuming that's currently being analyzed, and at some point we'll see it in a slew of papers. Is that kind of how you understand the process to work for this field campaign?
Yeah, they need to gather all this data, get it downloaded, and then the analysis process will start. And then, yeah, I'm sure you'll see papers about what we saw.
Nice. Well, we'll look forward to that. And one last question before I let you go, and we ask it to everyone. If you were to give advice to someone up and coming, what would your advice be? And what do you think the most important skill in your early career has been?
I'd say really focus on networking. I think for me especially, I made a lot of friends with the upperclassmen when I got into school, and then made sure to always be talking to professors and people in the field at conferences. I think that's helped me immensely going into the field, not only to have people to give me leads on, say, where the next job might be or what's going on in the field, but also just to have be able to talk to people and see what they like about their career, what they don't, and that can help provide you some direction with what to do with your career. I think that's what's really helping the most, building a strong network.
Gotcha. Well, thanks, Brad. Great advice, and I'm sure we'll have you back on sometime soon. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Dakota. It's been great to be here.
And that was Brad Gay talking to us about his experience recently with the TWRL project in the middle of the country.
Pretty awesome stories. I am super jealous, and I can't imagine what it's like to be that close to a EF4 tornado. I'd probably wouldn't want to be there, but still pretty amazing and pretty incredible. So hopefully I'm looking forward to the publications and research in the future on that data. Hopefully we get some stuff in the fall. Maybe next summer we'll see some of that data come out. So Tyler, any comments or thoughts on that before we wrap up?
No, I just think it's a great opportunity to work with the mobile radars while tornadoes are ongoing.
Yeah, agreed. All right, so that's going to do it for this week. If you don't follow us on Twitter, we're at the WX Junkies. We're also on Facebook. You can listen to this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, or iTunes. And if you're on iTunes, please, I'm begging you, give us a rating or review. We only have one review thus far on iTunes. And it's just nice to see what people think. Maybe, you know, change what we do. You can even send us a Twitter, a tweet, if you have a suggestion or comment. We love hearing from you. Tyler, what can we expect next week?
Next week, we are talking with Eric Blake. He is a hurricane specialist at the National Hurricane Center in Miami. He graduated with a bachelor's degree from the University of Louisiana at Monroe and a master's degree from Colorado State. He's been with the Hurricane Center for 10 years this year. And if you don't know, a hurricane specialist involves issuing tracks, intensity, wind radii, all these important forecasts for hurricanes. And they also deal with the watches and warnings for hurricanes. So great person to have on the show. A different topic, something that we haven't talked about. He actually worked with the late William Gray. So a lot to talk about next week. Very exciting. And we will have him on Thursday, and same time, 8 o'clock on Thursday evening. We'll hope you'll join us live or on demand right here next week.
Julia, we got cows.